This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the first weekend of October 2019. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Governor Abbott threatens Austin Mayor Steve Adler over the city's stance on homelessness.
I want you to know I understand the seriousness of this letter.
A shelter in East Austin that provides a safe haven for immigrants.
Because we're one of the few shelters in the interior of the United States that serves asylum seekers.
And what's the best way to get into Barton Springs Pool?
I mean, it touches on all the big areas of life. Physics, psychology, sociology, friendships, pain tolerance.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
Today I sent this letter to Austin Mayor Adler about the growing crisis arising from the Austin homeless policy.
This is Governor Abbott speaking earlier this week in a video he posted online.
Some businesses are struggling to keep sidewalks clear. Some homeowners feel threatened. Some homeless are interfering with sidewalks, with streets, and with rights of way. Feces and used needles are accumulating at alarming rates. Let me tell you. If Austin does not fix its homeless crisis by November the 1st, I will unleash the full authority of every state agency to protect the health and safety of all Texans.
Abbott says in his letter, for example, he could deploy the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality to monitor the water quality in local creeks, or have TxDOT remove encampments along highways that may endanger public safety, or deploy state troopers to, quote, Austin areas that pose greater threats, end quote. Now, Austin Mayor Steve Adler held a news conference after receiving the letter this week. He spoke about the issue for around 45 minutes, but here's just part of his response to Governor Abbott.
There are some people that read this letter as a threat. I want you to know I understand the seriousness of this letter, but I choose to read this letter as an offer of assistance. And this is not a city challenge. It is a statewide challenge. In fact, it's not even really just a state challenge. This is a national challenge among cities around the country. I look at this letter from the governor, and he points out that the Health and Human Services Commission might very well be able to bring us assistance in this city and all Texas cities. And I want you to know how much I welcome that offer of support and assistance.
KUT's Andrew Weber has been covering the issue of homelessness and city ordinances for us for a while now. Hello, Andrew.
Hi there, Nathan.
How big of a deal was this letter from Governor Abbott?
It was a pretty big deal. The state's highest elected official telling a mayor that, he's doing it wrong and that the city's doing it wrong, and then offering support, but actually in the form of what a lot of people viewed as a threat. I know Mayor Adler said that he viewed it as an offer of support, but objectively, you don't typically offer help by saying you're going to unleash help on a city.
That's a good point. As we heard, he said unleash right there, unleash the full resources of the state.
Right. And a lot of folks sort of read it in that threatening manner. I know Adler was sort of diplomatic about it. But Councilmember Greg Kassar, who sponsored the ordinance changes, was less diplomatic with his language.
So if the governor wants to help us and wants to be a part of that, great. But what I get from this letter is that he's actually just issuing a threat rather than issuing an offer to be a part of the solution. His letter sounds like what President Trump has been saying about essentially flooding the city with DPS, with troopers to clean up the streets. It sounds like martial law or something like that. And that's just not going to help.
I know you're also speaking to the main umbrella organization for homeless services in Austin. What's the group? Who'd you talk to? What'd they have to say about this letter from the governor?
Right. So the group is called ECHO, Ending Community Homelessness. I talked to their executive director, Matthew Malika. He said that the governor's letter wasn't necessarily based in fact or reality as far as what the governor was offering.
To the extent that there's concerns about the water quality now that these camping ordinances have been put in place and that all of a sudden there's increased issues with human defecation and waste in the water system for the state is absurd. There's no data backing that up, and it's not based in any reality. People experiencing homelessness were using the bathroom or going to the bathroom prior to these ordinance changes, and they're still using the bathroom. And I would argue that based on their ability to be in, you know, not be harassed and constantly moved, that they've been able to position themselves closer to places where they can use the restroom like everyone else that has a home.
Mayor Adler says, sure, if you want to send TCEQ to test waters, you know, Waller Creek specifically, which has historically been a spot where folks use the restroom, where homeless folks use the restroom. He said, sure, yeah, that's great. But what Matt Malika told me was that it was sort of disheartening that all of this has been wrapped in this, that everybody's retreated to their corners, that everybody's being so partisan about this. And it's an issue that is, he argued, a pretty bipartisan issue.
Is it that there are more people who don't have a place to live in Austin, or just that it's become more visible?
The city would argue that it's just folks are more visible, that they're coming out of urban forest kind of areas and what used to be historic camps along 35 at Riverside, East Riverside, just like big wooded areas where folks used to camp all the time on down in South Austin on Woodward too, by that Home Depot, that folks are coming out into public because they want to be more visible, because it's more safe. It's hard to really quantify any of this, and this is one of the most frustrating things about covering it. There's a point in time count, is what it's called. It is a sort of census on the homeless population in every city that happens every January. That is a single point in time. That is a single night that cities that are receiving federal money have to count folks and tell HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, how many folks are homeless in a city to receive funding. Having said that, there is also another metric for folks who receive services. And that can range anywhere from that number to 2,000 in Austin, 2,255, to somewhere around 10,000, because folks receive services through service providers and they're still counted, but may be temporarily homeless, may not be chronically homeless. So there is this range, this gap in just trying to nail down the population that is super frustrating for a lot of people. Having said that, cities typically go by the point in time count. Adler and other members of the city council have said, yeah, we're not creating more homeless people. They're just more visible.
The issue with the point in time count, I think you've gone out on the point in time count one year.
Yes,
I did it once. A lot of people volunteer their time to spend all night trying to tally the number of homeless people in Travis County. And when I went out with a group in downtown, what struck me was just how unscientific it seemed. I mean, you're literally walking the streets looking for people who, quote unquote, look homeless. Sometimes you see a guy, oh, that guy, does he not have a place to live? Let's go ask him. No, he has a place to live and we just basically insulted him. You're trying to figure out who's homeless and who's not, and it can be very difficult. And it's really like for us, it was a group of, I don't know, eight people covering a huge swath of downtown. And I can see how you could miss people who are out there. I always kind of view that 2,000 number as more of an estimate, but the city tends to talk about it, or at least elected officials talk about it as if it's like this is the hard and fast number. And I'm wondering what your experience was when you went out on that point in time count.
Right. We went out, with Gabriel Perez for just to cover it, just to get some tape, and Gabriel got some great photos. We were out in South Austin. We were steered toward areas that at East Riverside and 35, where there typically are, rather were, this was before the ordinances were rolled back, where there were big camps. And it was one of those things where our team lead had done, you know, I think a handful of point in time counts. She was very experienced. She works for HACA, the Housing Authority of the City of Austin. She and her other coworkers went out, and they know spots around there because they work like right across 35. But it was one of those things where it's not scientific. We went to where this spot was, where these folks knew that typically there were people and there weren't people. And so I think that it's kind of a shot in the dark sometimes.
Do you know what the governor was referring to when he talked about feces and used needles accumulating? What was he talking about?
He was referring to purely anecdotal evidence because we've reached out to folks. We've reached out to Austin Public Health. We've reached out to APD. We've reached out to 311 as far as to see if they're getting calls about this stuff. And yes, they are, but there's no way to determine if that is actual fact unless you witness someone defecating in public or, you know, you see needles on the ground. And there's not really a system. Again, there are holes in the data that's kind of frustrating. But at the same time, that's just been all over social media and people document it if they see it. Adler multiple times in the press conference referred to it as the quote memes. It's been a conversation on social media that is simply to just rail against the Austin City Council's policies. And then you have other folks on the other side who are maybe not as boisterous in what they're posting, but are defending the city and what they do. So it's kind of this just loggerheads, flashpoint kind of moment that is frustrating to service providers because they just want to help folks get into homes.
So what is the city council supposed to do next? I think there was talk of revision of the ordinances in October, but then the mayor had some different ideas. What is going to happen next?
There's sort of this uncertainty whether the city council is going to vote to revise the ordinances or if they want to do it in an administrative way that would sort of lean on City Manager Spencer Kronk and APD to clarify these rules as far as enforcement goes. They could vote on something on October 17th. It's not really clear yet. So it's all kind of, at this point, up in the air, though Mayor Adler did promise that Governor Abbott would see action by next week in reference to the governor's November 1st deadline for that state intervention.
KUT's Andrew Weber. You can read all his reporting about this at KUT.org. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thank you, Nathan.
September 2019 is in the books, and we can now say that this was the hottest September ever recorded in Austin. KUT's Mo Bouchel has the details.
The average temperature this September was almost 88 degrees. It was about 3 degrees hotter than September 2011, the previous record holder. And the record breaking doesn't end there. This September also had more triple digit days than any previous September. We had 19 in this month alone, says Ethan Williams, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service.
And just for comparison, the previous record holder back in 2011 for the warmest September had 14 triple digit degree days. So we had 5 more days of 100 degrees or warmer than 2011.
In the short term, there may be some relief on the horizon. Forecasters think a cold front might move into the area by early next week. But in the long term, hotter summers and falls are part of a new normal, as greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuels continue to warm the Earth's atmosphere. Moz Bouchel, KUT News.
New research finds a nearly 20-year difference in life expectancy between people living in neighborhoods in West Austin and East Austin. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports the data found these disparities are largely correlated to poverty, education, and race.
The study compiled 6 years of mortality and population data for census tracts across Texas. Researchers found some neighborhoods in western Travis County have life expectancies as high as 89 years of age, while some neighborhoods in East Austin have life expectancies as low as 71 years. The Episcopal Health Foundation's Brian Sasser says there were big differences in neighborhoods fairly close together.
I think this is a way to show, even within cities and even within counties, there are huge health disparities, you know, 5-10 miles apart, in some cases a couple miles apart.
Sasser says non-medical factors like transportation, housing, community safety, and access to healthy food are making big differences in closing gaps between neighborhoods. He says it's something local leaders and policymakers should consider as they address health needs. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
A group called the Austin Coalition for Transit is supporting light rail for the proposed Orange Line Corridor. This is under Capital Metro's big plan, Project Connect. KUT Samuel King reports the coalition believes rail would do a better job of easing traffic than buses.
The Orange Line would run along the Guadalupe-Lamar and South Congress corridors for roughly 20 miles. The route includes some of the most densely populated and congested areas of the city. Andrew Clements with the Austin Coalition for Transit says that's just one of the reasons why his group feels light rail would be the most effective solution, rather than bus rapid transit, which would also have a dedicated lane.
The public should be given the option of dedicating a street lane to light rail, because if the goal is to move people rather than vehicles, then light rail is going to be the most efficient.
The coalition also wants a direct connection between the Orange Line and a line which would run to Austin Bergstrom International Airport. The Capital Metro Board and the Austin City Council will meet in the coming weeks to discuss those and other options. Samuel King, KUT News.
The Austin Independent School District held meetings every day this week to talk with parents about plans to close and consolidate 12 schools. And there was a lot of frustration.
It's a bait and switch, because in 2017, they told us, vote for this, and I voted. Vote for this bond, we're going to make your schools better. But all of a sudden, you're closing the schools down now.
KUT's Claire McInerney has been covering this. Hello, Claire.
Hi, Nathan.
Who did we just hear from there?
That's Ruth Tovar. She's a parent of kids at Brook Elementary, and she spoke at a regional meeting Tuesday. And what she was talking about is, hey, the people from the district come to us every couple of years for bonds, and we vote for them, and we've supported your big plans before. But for example, she's saying Brook hasn't seen some changes from the 2013 bond. 2017 bond was saying, we're going to improve your schools, but now they're closing. And so she's just saying, like, why should we trust you on this plan?
There have been 8 meetings since we spoke last Friday. What are some of the things that you've been hearing at these meetings that are similar to last week?
Well, people are still saying, slow down this process. Why does this have to be voted on in November? It just feels so fast for us to digest it and understand it. Another is, why our school? And there were some updates to that question. The district has said they're going to release, they're calling it like version 1.1. And it's just the same document we saw September 5th, but they're going to add more like, here's how we came to the conclusion to close every school. Because everyone's been saying, you know, either our building's not the oldest, or our scores are really good, or we have a really successful program. And the district answer has been, well, yeah, it wasn't just one of those things. So they're going to supposedly next week send out a new version that explains how we got there. But then another thing we heard for the first time this week in response to the question, why our school, was from Dr. Paul Cruz, the superintendent. A lot of people said, why so many schools on the east side? Aren't you just disproportionately hurting kids who go to schools where there's lots of kids in poverty? And he said, yes, but that's on purpose. Because for the schools that close, they're going to consolidate them and build a brand new building for this consolidated school. And he said, we want more kids in poverty to go to these brand new schools and have the new technology and have the better opportunities than anyone else in the district.
There are obviously some major questions about what's going on with middle schools in East Austin. Yeah. What did you hear about that this week, Claire?
Yes. So one of the big ones came up at a regional meeting at Northeast High School, which was formerly called Reagan. The plan says that the high school would expand to include grades 6 through 8. And a lot of people came to that meeting and said, so is this our only option if we live in this area? Because the plan also says they're going to close the all-girls middle school, Bertha Sadler Means. And a lot of parents said, I don't want my middle schooler in a high school setting. The district clarified and said, this 6 through 8 program is optional. Parents can opt into it if they want their kid to have the programming at the high school, but it won't be a zoned middle school situation, which still leaves some people with concerns because they're building a new middle school in Mueller, but it's not done yet. The district's saying that it will be done by the time Sadler Means closes, but we know construction timelines can change. And then many people at Sadler Means this morning told our colleague Sangeeta Menon, who went, that they're worried about that school closing and leaving girls kind of in a lurch because the all-boys version, Gus Garcia, is staying open. And so the plan says girls could go down to Ann Richards, but people are saying that's really far from here. And then we don't really have another option right now. And they were also concerned about the 6 through 8 situation.
AISD's school changes proposal has been out for a month now. And I'm wondering, over that time, have you seen a change in the attitudes of parents and people in the community who are paying attention to this?
No, not really. Everyone is still, you know, very upset, very questioning, very distrustful, very emotional. And part of that is because the district doesn't have a really strong plan for what the transition will look like. So, for example, they say we're going to close Maplewood and send kids to Campbell, but families don't have an answer as to, well, what will that look like? Are all these kids going to be housed in Maplewood? Are we going to bring in a bunch of portable classrooms? No one really knows. And so because of that lack of clarity, people are still super frustrated.
Austin ISD's primary justification for all of these changes has been declining enrollment. Some numbers came out last night that showed there's actually been an increase, a slight increase in enrollment. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the district did see an increase in around 600 kids, and they were anticipating for another loss of over 1,000 kids. And that just plays into another question that many parents have of, so we're making this decision to close schools because a demographic projection says we're going to lose kids in the next 10 years. And so if we got more kids this year when we were expecting a loss, can we really trust this report? And here's AISD spokesperson Renee Tejas talking about that.
And we are pleased with the enrollment, but I think it's important to remember that we have and we're seeing a trend. We have lost 6,000 students over the past 5 years. And while we're pleased with the initial numbers we've seen in this one particular year, I don't know that it bucks a trend. However, I will say that the numbers show we have our strongest growth in our high schools and especially our middle schools. And part of the school changes certainly does include more and better programming, but those discussions also include possible consolidations, primarily at the elementary school level. In the overall attendance that we've gained, approximately 600 to 700 students at this point in time, you'll find that the elementary school level is the only level that actually appears it's going to be losing students.
So, Claire, these meetings are going to continue next week. What else should people be paying attention to?
So there's no meetings on Monday, and that's because there is a school board work session. So this isn't a board meeting where they vote for anything, but they just kind of discuss issues. And I am sure when that agenda comes out later this afternoon, we will see that they're going to be talking about school changes. And a few board members have said publicly at these meetings this week, yeah, I have lots of questions and we're going to ask them. So I'll be at that meeting Monday, and that might be another way to get clarification on how this process is going to progress, because the board is the one who ultimately has to vote.
KUT's Claire McInerney joining us with the latest on Austin ISD's conversations with parents and community members about plans to close and consolidate 12 campuses. Claire, thank you so much for this.
Oh yeah, thank you, Nathan.
For many people seeking asylum or citizenship in the United States, getting here is just the start. And then there's the often very long legal work that needs to be done to remain in the country. And some families don't have shelter. Here in Austin, there's Casa Marianella, which is the only local homeless shelter dedicated to the immigrant population. KUT's Julia Yort reports on the program and the people it is trying to help.
Casa Marianella owns a handful of homes. The main house sits on a quiet, tree-lined block in a colorful residential neighborhood in East Austin. Across the street, two other buildings house a benefits clinic, a law office, a free acupuncture clinic, and more beds, specifically for families. Jennifer Long is the executive director of Casa.
What we started seeing a year ago was the arrival of entire families at the border, because we're one of the few shelters in the interior of the United States that serves asylum seekers. A lot of those people have made their way to our door.
Since last year, she says Casa hasn't had enough beds to keep up with demand. As of July, 85 people, including young kids, were living at Casa. But there's only space for 38 people.
The families are just staying here temporarily and kind of sleeping in mats on the floor while we look for another place for them to go. So we're just doing the best we can to keep them from being out on the street until we can find the appropriate sponsorship for them.
According to Long, most people who show up at Casa are just looking for their basic needs to be met. a place to sleep, a home-cooked meal, and daycare for their kids while they go through court proceedings. Though many are from Central America, Long has seen an increase in migrants and refugees from African countries over the past 10 years. I'm Thérèse. I'm from the Democratic Republic of Congo, Kinshasa, and I'm 39 years old. Last July, Thérèse said goodbye to her two teenage kids and began her journey to the U.S. to seek asylum. For 3 months, she and five others traveled in a group from Angola to Colombia and into Central America to Mexico. They traveled by boat, bus, and foot. Out of the six people in the group, three died. It was not easy for me to get here. I was looking for a country that respects human rights and a country that has democracy. My country does not respect human rights or democracy. This is why I made the three-month journey. When she got to the border, Thérèse surrendered to ICE agents. For 8 months, she was held at five different detention centers. But when she finally got her day in court, she represented herself and won asylum in the U.S. From there, she ended up on Casa Marianela's doorstep. They gave me food, they gave me a place to sleep, and they looked at my papers and said, "It's okay, we'll help you." Thérèse is one of over 250,000 asylum seekers who come to the U.S. each year, escaping persecution in their home country. Now that she's won asylum, she plans on making a better life for her kids. Her first step? English lessons. I have to prepare for the future of my children. They're over there without a father, without a family, and I have to get used to the way of life in this country. Rosalidia, a Spanish-speaking Salvadorian migrant, also has plans for a better future for her daughter Liliana, who still lives in El Salvador with her grandmother. Liliana suffers from a bone disease that impairs her walking. Not long ago, she was raped by the gang MS-13. Rosalidia has crossed the border twice, once in 2010 and again in 2016, to try to change her daughter's reality. She's my only daughter. She's everything to me. She's my princess. And the only thing I can ask from the U.S. government is that my daughter can be here next to me one day. In 2016, Rosalidia crossed at San Ysidro, the largest port of entry between San Diego and Tijuana. She was caught by immigration and detained for a little under a year and 4 months in four different detention centers in California, where she says immigration officers treated her inhumanely. I woke up with big bruises on my chest. "Why?" I said. "I'm not doing anything wrong." The officer twisted my arm like this, backwards. She says the living conditions were also unsanitary. They threw our food at us like we were dogs. And if a person didn't eat it, they would get punished. There are lots of dirty things over there, like the bathrooms. Rosalidia is now working towards a T visa, which is a temporary work permit for survivors of human trafficking. It allows immigrants to stay in the U.S. for up to 4 years with the possibility of an extension. The big draw for Rosalidia is that in some cases, the T visa allows trafficking survivors to bring their families to the U.S. In the meantime, Rosalidia keeps her mind active and her hands occupied. Every day she makes figurines, ducks, swans, pumpkins, out of cardstock. Making these figurines is like therapy for me. When I make these things, I do them thinking of my daughter. I'm always trying to focus on something else so I don't constantly think about her, about what's going on over there, if she's hungry, if she needs anything, if she's experiencing trauma. With the help of Casa Marianela, Rosalidia and Thérèse move forward in hopes that their kids will one day join them in the U.S. Julia Yort, KUT News.
It's not just municipal property taxes going up. The city of Austin is raising fees for a number of government services. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey has been tallying it all up for us. Hello, Audrey.
Hi, Nathan.
When do these new fees take effect, first of all?
Today, October 1st, which is the start of the city's fiscal year.
One of the things you looked at was the fee for trash collection. And how much is that going up?
So the typical household, which the city says uses a 64-gallon can, is going to be expected to pay $7.80 more than they did last year. That's an annual fee, so about $8 more for the year.
Why is the city raising that fee?
Austin Resource Recovery, which runs the city's trash pickup program, did a cost of service analysis. And basically what they found is that they needed to be charging people more because it cost them more to pick up your trash.
Another fee going up is for people who have short-term rentals. What's that about?
So for folks who don't know, a short-term rental is when you rent your home or a room in your home on sites like Airbnb or HomeAway, and you're required to have a license through the city of Austin. To get that initial license, you're going to have to pay $522 for the year, which is up from $500 the year before. If you want to renew your license, which you're expected to do every year, you're now going to pay $313, which is $13 more than last year.
Austin owns its electric utility, Austin Energy, and Austin Energy is going to be raising fees a little bit as well, right?
Yes, yeah. So Austin Energy says the typical customer is going to have to pay almost $16 more in the next year on their energy bill. And that's basically, you know, a similar reason why the trash pickup cost is going up is that the department says that it now just costs more to provide energy to your house.
This was interesting and something I had not thought about. Cremation at a public cemetery will cost more.
Yeah, so the city of Austin owns several cemeteries. If you are cremated or interred in these cemeteries, most of those prices are going up. For example, if you are looking to be cremated or have a loved one cremated, it's now going to cost you $400, up $35 from the year before.
The city charges in the utility bill that we get a fee for litter cleanup. What's that fee called?
Yeah, so it's called Clean Community Fee. You might have seen this in your City of Austin bill every month and wondered, what is this? So as you mentioned, Nathan, it pays for litter cleanup, street sweeping, things we may not often think about, but things that keep our city clean. And this year, City Council is actually thinking about lowering this fee to offset that higher trash pickup price. But you know, at the last minute before they took a vote, they decided to keep it where it's at and to actually have the city study this price. The city was going to be able to lower this fee because they realized that they didn't need to collect as much money as they were to clean up litter or clean up the streets. But council members decided to keep it at the same level because they wanted to study this price and also see if they could use the additional revenue to help clean up some homelessness camps in the city.
Of course, all of this is in addition to increases in property tax. Remind us what the property tax increase will be.
Sure. So your property taxes are going up. If you own a home that's worth about $350,000, you're going to pay about $92 more this year in city property taxes. That would bring the total bill of someone who owns a house in that range and is not a senior to a little over $1,400 a year in city property taxes. Now, remember, city property taxes are just a portion of your property taxes, so likely you're going to see an increase higher than that.
KUT's Audrey McGlinchey going over some of the fee increases the city of Austin is enacting. You can find a story about this running down the list at KUT.org. Thank you so much, Audrey.
Thanks, Nathan.
The forecast calls for another hot weekend, highs in the 90s. This is October. Monday, we might get down to more seasonal temperatures, but for this weekend, could be a good one to go to take a dip at Barton Springs pool. Be ready for lots of company, though. It's Austin City Limits Music Festival weekend, and this pool is a constant 70 degrees. Very refreshing on a hot day, at least after you get over the shock of jumping into the water. That was on the mind of one listener who asked our AT Explained project about it. So KUT's Matt Largy went to investigate.
All right, where do you want to go?
Well, when I come here, I usually...
This is Susan Summers Willett. We've come for a swim because she's got a question.
We are here at Barton Springs Pool to determine what method is the best way to get into the icy waters of Barton Springs.
Do you think we're going to come to a definitive conclusion here?
I don't know, because people have strong opinions about this.
People do have opinions, but maybe it's about more than that.
I've always wondered about this question, you know, just in terms of science and physics and biology.
Yeah, because it's not like a straight up personal preference thing. It seems like there's a real scientific answer here, maybe.
Right, but your personal preference definitely influences your experience of getting into the pool. You know, there's the science and then there's the psychology.
Does science hold the answer to a less uncomfortable entry into 70-degree water? Or is it simply about mind over body?
Man, this question is so deep.
It really is. I mean, it like touches on all the big areas of life. Physics, psychology, sociology, friendships, pain tolerance.
It's a lot.
Let's get into this.
Okay, so what are our options for getting in the pool?
There are two sort of main methods for getting into the pool. One is the jump in and die for 30 seconds method, because you feel like you're dying.
Jeez, yeah, that sounds horrible.
And the other method is what my friend Austin calls the slow march toward frigid truth.
We'll march toward that frigid truth in a minute, but Susan prefers to just jump in.
When you jump in, you just feel it all at once.
So we head down to the deep end. We find an empty space in the water. Susan steps to the edge, and she just kind of stands there.
What are you thinking about when you're standing on the edge of the pool?
I look at all the people in the pool, and I think about how much fun they're having. You know, like, I just think, you know, I want to be like that person.
I don't know. You look down at the water, and what are the sensations that you imagine?
Thousands of knives stabbing your body.
She stands there for another minute. And then...
3, 2, 1.
Susan comes up looking shocked. She's clearly uncomfortable.
Woo! Lord!
Before we go any further, let's back it up. So what's actually happening to your body when you jump into Barton Springs? Let's listen to Susan's jump again with help from Dr. Christopher Zibel. He's the medical director of the emergency department at Del Seton Medical Center.
Remember that you're 98 degrees, and so 70 degrees is almost 30 degrees away from where you are.
3, 2, 1.
First thing that happens is you feel that shock to the system. Arteries and veins in your skin will immediately constrict. Woo! Things will also stiffen up.
Lord!
The heart rate slows down and the blood pressure falls a little bit.
Cold. It's still cold.
It's designed to help protect people from lots and lots of activity that would create currents that would wash away your body heat.
At this point, you might be saying, but Matt, 70 degrees isn't that cold. 70 degrees is actually quite comfortable. Room temperature is like 72 or something like that. Well, the thing is, water is a much better conductor of heat than air.
So when you get down into the water, your body heat will float through the water away from your body much better than it does in the air. So your body being 98 degrees, the water being 70 degrees, that's a very steep gradient through which the heat will leave your body very quickly.
That's going to happen no matter how you get in. So let's check out another way.
Could I get you to introduce yourself?
Yeah. Tracy McCaskill.
All right. You live here in Austin?
I do live here. I've been here about 20 years.
You've been coming to Barton Springs all that time?
When I can, yeah.
I found Tracy near the shallow end of the pool, about to get in. She doesn't always get in down here. She likes to mix it up.
So it's different every time. Sometimes you use the stairs. Sometimes you jump right in. What do you do?
It's the mood. I think it's just the mood and how you're feeling about it.
How are you feeling today?
Slow entry. Very slow entry today.
Tracy stands at the top of the stairs at the shallowest part of the pool. I ask her to count the steps down.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4... 5, 6.
She tenses up.
Cold. 7 and 8.
Arteries and veins contracting. Blood pressure definitely falling.
It's very slippery. Okay, I'm gonna drop it. Okay, ready?
Austin.
Oh, so cold.
There are other options, like the ramp, where I find Andrew Feenstra.
It's going to be slow and probably a little painful, but...
Perfect. That's why we're here.
We'll work through it.
He starts down the ramp.
So yeah, this is where you got to kind of hurry into the water because your feet are starting to burn a little bit. Last thing you want to do is slip and fall in front of everybody. Then you burn your hand on the rail as you go. Oh, it's cold. It's always cold. We're about to get to the worst part right now, too. Whew. Whew. My voice gets a little higher. This is where we just got to, these guys get in.
Okay, one more. The buddy system. Sometimes it helps if you've got a friend that's counting on you to jump when they jump. I find two girls on the edge of the deep end.
Okay, I don't want to jump in and then you don't jump in with me. Come up, we push you. This is me. Ready?
Wait.
We've been at this for like 15 minutes.
No, it's been
like... You've been at this for 15 minutes?
Like 10.
No, it's been 5.
It's been 5 minutes.
It feels like 15.
Yeah, it does. My feet are burning.
This goes on for a minute.
Okay.
Yeah, it looks like
ready?
Fun.
1, 2, 3.
Finally, you can jump in style on the diving board. I find our question asker, Susan, still in the pool near the diving board. Did we get everything?
You know, I think that covers the major methods for getting in. I mean, then of course the question is where you get in.
Which side? How deep?
So it's a major philosophical question.
I don't know if we're going to be able to answer that one, but at least we can do the science.
We can do the science. I'm curious about the science.
Is there an ideal way to get into Barton Springs, like from a medical perspective, in terms of creating the least discomfort?
Boy, if there is, I haven't figured out what it is yet.
Dr. Christopher Zibel again.
So it's really just a personal preference.
It really is. There's not a medically right answer to that question of how do you get into cold water. I think it's whatever way works for you works.
How do you get in?
I get in all at once because the more I ease myself in, the more torturous it seems to me. So I'm going to go the deep end and jump in.
Well, I guess we've been doing it the best way all along, no matter how you do it. Matt Largy, KUT News.
Lord!
Do you have a special ritual for getting into Barton Springs? Let us know at KUT.org. And you can find more in our AT Explained series at atexplained.org. You can subscribe to the podcast there or ask your own question. That's atexplained.org. That's KUT Weekend for the first weekend of October 2019. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org or just ask me on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. ¶¶